All right. But clearly, you cannot stop with dependencies. You can't stop with contingencies. You've got to provide some kind of explanation for all of this. By definition, that is going to require something non-contingent or absolute to explain it. So in order to make any sense out of the universe as we experience it, you must appeal to an absolute, to something non-contingent, to something independent. And that, by definition, we're simply defining it that way, that, by definition, is God. That is to say, that which explains the universe in which we find ourselves. Now you say, but doesn't that put you in the same situation as you were a few minutes ago with a little kid? Because a little kid can say, if he is particularly precocious, but now explain the non-contingent, Daddy, or something to that effect. In other words, offer some explanation for the absolute. But think about it for a moment. As a result of our clean-cut statement of this, getting it down to the fundamental argument, you can see that that can't be asked for. Because by definition, we are appealing from the dependent to the independent or non-contingent. Something that's independent or non-contingent, by definition, doesn't require anything beyond it to explain it. Now you say, but in that case, how are we helped by all of this? Why couldn't we just stop with the universe in which we find ourselves? Why have we got to stop with an absolute or a non-contingent? Why do we have to take this a second step? Why can't we just say that the world is eternal? Our universe has always been there, and not even ask for a God as an explanation. Well, the answer to this is, of course, that everything we come across in this world is dependent. Right? In other words, if you take the world in which you find yourself, that world isn't a stopping point. That world isn't a stopping point. So you've got to appeal to something outside of the world and beyond it as the stopping point. To assume that a universe in which everything you encounter is contingent, is somehow non-contingent, is irrational. The proper approach is to say, well, everything I come across in this universe is not able to explain itself, so if I want any explanation, I'm going to have to go beyond this universe. Suppose a non-Christian, though, says something like this, but really, all you need to explain this universe in which you find yourself is something or somebody just a itty-bitty bit more powerful than the universe in which we're in. In other words, take the cosmic billiard table analogy again. All you need is a sufficiently powerful billiard player to break. He wouldn't have to be an infinite billiard player, nor would he have to be an absolute billiard player. He'd just have to be a sufficiently good billiard player to be able to get this universe going. All right, let's think about this for a moment. We take the universe we're now in. To explain it, we appeal beyond it to a force or a person more extensive and powerful than the universe in which we find ourselves, able to explain it, but not infinite. Okay? But of course, that appeal is to something or someone which, though more powerful than we, is nevertheless unable to explain himself and is not absolute. So, when we move from our universe to this explanation for our universe, that explanation is not self-sufficient. That will require us appealing beyond it to something capable of explaining it. Right? Now, either that is absolute and independent and doesn't require going beyond it, or it isn't. If it is absolute, we stop right there. If it isn't, we've got to go back again. And ultimately, we have always got to predicate something absolute in order to stop the series. If that's the case, then why bother with the intermediate steps? If you've got to get to that anyway, then you might as well simply predicate it the minute you leave this universe. You've accomplished nothing to insert a series of steps. And if the reply comes back, but I still don't see why you've got to go beyond this universe, even one step, the answer is, for heaven's sake, this universe doesn't explain itself. That immediately forces us to go beyond it. The question is simply, how far do we need to go? Answer, we've got to go to the absolute, or we'd have to keep going. And suppose you kept going infinitely, all right? Suppose you just went on infinitely, sort of an infinite regress. Well, if you did that, of course, you never would explain any of the terms in the series. Right? And that would accomplish nothing. The series has got to stop. It's got to stop with the independent. It's got to stop with the absolute. And under those circumstances, you might as well stop with it the minute that you leave the universe in which you are presently involved. That is the underlying argument of the classical proofs. And the argument is unbeatable philosophically. It is unbeatable philosophically. If you would like to see an example of its use, you ought to read the debate that took place between Frederick Copleston, the great Jesuit philosopher, historian of philosophy, and Bertrand Russell on the BBC, British Broadcasting Third Program, back 20 years or so. I've included a relevant passage from that debate in which Copleston cleans up Bertie in my book, Christianity for the Tough-Minded. In the beginning essay, you have the reference to that debate and a key passage from this. And Bertrand Russell was not able to answer this argument presented by Copleston. I don't know if you're acquainted with Copleston, but he is the greatest living historian of philosophy. He's done an eight-volume history of philosophy, which is available in paperback. He's one of the great philosophers of our time. This argument is sound as it can be, and I want to illustrate it from contemporary scientific theory, and I want you to hang on to your hats, because this gets a little bit technical. We're going to talk about the second law of thermodynamics. This is an illustration of the contingency argument. As we've already said, you can illustrate the contingency argument from anything, because anything that you look at is going to be dependent. The second law of thermodynamics just looks at the universe from one standpoint, and that's the standpoint of energy. And in looking at the universe from the standpoint of energy, the conclusion comes that the universe must have begun a finite time ago. In other words, there has to be a God who has brought the universe into existence. What I'm going to present to you now is not a cute argument of theologians. This is an argument which is so powerful in contemporary physics that some of the foremost specialists in thermodynamics have affirmed the existence of God on the basis of it. And I refer you to the basic text in thermodynamics by Gordon Van Wylen, V-A-N, capital W-Y-L-E-N. This is published by John Wiley in Philadelphia. It's one of the standard texts in thermodynamics that's used in engineering schools. And there, Van Wylen and his associate affirm in the text that the second law of thermodynamics leads to the existence of God, and they themselves hold to the existence of God on the basis of this, that they cannot both hold to the second law of thermodynamics and deny the existence of God. Notice that if this is a correct form of argumentation, it parallels our fundamental technique that we were talking about last time. that the very same reasoning that takes one to the second law of thermodynamics, if applied to a religious question, takes one to the existence of God. So your choice is perfectly clear. You either go along with the existence of God, or you simply dump the second law of thermodynamics, which is a very difficult thing to do. The three laws of thermodynamics are fundamental in contemporary physics and engineering. We are not saying that they couldn't be revised, expanded, or altered in the future. All we're saying is that right now, in the midst of the three laws of thermodynamics, certain conclusions are required. Anyway, what we're going to illustrate now is just one of the ways of applying this contingency argument. If the second law of thermodynamics were to be revised or altered in the future, that wouldn't in any way touch the fundamental contingency argument. It would only say that we had not analyzed the energy problem as fully as we thought we did. All right, what is the second law of thermodynamics in reference to this problem? The second law of thermodynamics talks about what happens to available energy in a closed system. Think of a closed system. Think of a box, or think of an automobile gas tank, if you will. If you have available energy in a closed system and an irreversible process operating in the closed system, and this system is left to itself, the second law of thermodynamics declares that the available heat energy will decline until finally it reaches zero, or heat death. There will be a continual loss of available heat energy in this irreversible system. The term employed for this is entropy. Entropy. Entropy means the loss of available heat energy. And so the engineers talk about entropy increasing with time in a closed system. Entropy increasing with time. That's a very bizarre way of putting it, of course, because entropy means the loss of available heat energy. When you say entropy increases with time, that means you get less and less available heat energy. You would imagine that they would employ a term which would correlate directly with the way things operate, but that's due to the fact that engineers have no knowledge of the English language, whatever. Most of them are unable to read at all. They're only able to figure. And that explains why you get this strange phenomenon of an increase in entropy, which means a decrease in the loss, in the decrease in the amount of available heat energy. I'll be referring to engineers at other points in these lectures, and you'll see that that's very much the case. However, be that as it may, think of the automobile with the gas tank. The gas tank has gas in it, right? And it's an irreversible process in the sense that the engine in the automobile does not produce gas for the gas tank. The gas gets used up in running the automobile. So there you are. You're in your car. Off you go. And there is a closed system, meaning that you don't stop at any gas tanks along the way. Inevitably and eventually, there will come a time when there is no more available energy. The car will stop. And that will be that. Now, the atheist conceives of the universe necessarily as such a system. Necessarily, the atheist conceives of the universe this way. Why? Because an atheist doesn't believe in God, by definition. Therefore, he insists that the universe is all there is. Right? The universe, therefore, is a closed system in the sense that there's nothing outside of it. There's nothing outside of it. The universe is all there is. According to the second law of thermodynamics, in a closed system with an irreversible process, which is time in this instance, you will arrive at heat death in a finite amount of time. A finite amount of time. However, The atheist holds that the universe has always been around, right? Because there isn't anything beyond it. The universe is all there is. So the universe has been here for an infinite amount of time. The second law of thermodynamics states, however, that in any closed system, heat death will arrive in a finite amount of time. Now think about this logically. If the atheist is right, there has therefore already been more than enough time to reach heat death, because his universe has always been here, but only a finite amount of time is necessary to reach heat death. Now, the fact that the atheist still has enough energy left to discuss the question makes painfully clear that heat death has not yet arrived. Okay? Conclusion, there is something the matter with the assumptions of the atheist. The assumptions the atheist is using are off. And what's the problem here? The problem is simply this. Think of the automobile again. In order for the car to keep going, you would have to have somebody putting gas into it. You'd have to be able to stop at gas tanks along the way, gas stations along the way, and gas would have to be put in. But the atheist hasn't got any cosmic gas station attendant around. There isn't anybody to feed more energy into the universe to keep it going. Moreover, the atheist isn't able to explain the situation at the outset. For the atheist, the universe has always been there by definition, so there wasn't anybody to feed gas into the system to begin with. Clearly, the only thing that can account for all of this is that the universe is not infinite. The universe is not infinite. The universe in which we find ourselves is not infinite. Because if it were infinite, it already would have reached heat death. The very fact that you haven't got a universal running down yet, which will occur in a finite period of time, means that the universe came into existence a finite period of time ago. And or there is somebody feeding energy into it from the outside. But either of those possibilities is anathema to the atheist. The atheist will not buy either of those, right? The atheist won't allow for a creator, and the atheist won't allow for something outside the universe feeding energy into it. But you've got to appeal to at least one of those in order to be able to explain why the universe hasn't run down. And either one you appeal to will require an assertion of God's existence. But suppose a person comes back to you and he says, "Ah, but I hold to a steady state universe. I hold that the universe as we have it does indeed appear to run down." But what's really happening is that the energy is, the universe runs down to a point, then it expands again. There's a steady state of contraction and expansion. And thus, the universe is eternal, and it always goes through these cycles. And all we're doing is looking at it at one point in the cycle. And so this doesn't necessarily require an appeal to the existence of God at all. Well, the answer to this is the old philosophical aphorism that if a thing looks like a banana, tastes like a banana, and smells like a banana, and you want to prove it's a cucumber, the burden of proof rests on you, not on the person who claims it's a banana. I mean, this is the fundamental principle that I'm now going to illustrate. If any time you see the universe, it's running down, and someone claims that as a matter of fact, it runs down, but then it expands again, the burden of proof rests upon him to show the expansion. You see? Because all of our experience indicates the running down. Sometimes this is put in a very clever way, as if you had a universe something like a barbell. and things run down on this side, but that sort of squeegees the energy into the other side, and then after it gets way down on this side, then it squeegees down on the other side and forces it into the first half of the barbell so that you have a constant, steady state. Well, think about this logically for a moment. All that's ever seen is one half of this. So what gives you the idea that there is any other half, if you please? Moreover, suppose you wanted to solve your economic problem, your financial entropy, the notion that money left to itself continually declines, all right? There's a continual loss of available capital. Unless more capital is fed in by your father sending you money from home. You know, that sort of thing. Let's say you want to solve that problem, and you solve it by establishing two bank accounts. All right? And what you do when things look bad with the first bank account, what you do is you take money out of the second bank account and you put it in the first. And then you concentrate attention on the first. And when you get depressed about the second bank account, you transfer money from the first into the second. And then you concentrate on that and you feel much better. Now, if you talked with someone about this and you pointed out that that was the solution to the entropy problem, solution to financial entropy, the person would say, "You bone brain! You've only got a certain amount of money. And it doesn't make a bit of difference whether you keep it all in one account or whether you put it in 18 different accounts. You're still in the same position. If the money gets spent, eventually everything is going to fall in. You're going to come to money death eventually with this, regardless of any transfers." You know, there are people who write checks on one account to put money in their second account. And there have even been some sneaky people who have three accounts going and they're constantly running checks around in a circle. But it's perfectly obvious that at worst it's fraud, and at best they're just kidding themselves. The end result is absolutely going to be the same. Unless money is fed in from the outside, the person's going to go broke. And that's exactly the point of the second law of thermodynamics. It says that the universe, if conceived of in the way in which the atheist does conceive it, would already have gone broke. It hasn't. Thus, the atheist is not conceiving of the universe adequately. I've set this forth in the first essay of Christianity for the Tough-Minded, if you'd like to have it in detail form. If you have any engineering background, you would enjoy getting Van Wieland's engineering text and seeing how he works with this. In current philosophy, there are people who maintain that there's no sense in even trying to argue for the existence of God, because the very idea of God is a nonsensical idea. The idea of God has no sense to it. It has no meaningfulness to it. And therefore, obviously, there's no sense in asking the question as to whether you can prove the existence of God. This viewpoint is especially manifested by analytical philosophers within the school of analytical philosophy. And I don't want to give the impression that I think that this school is basically negative. I don't. I feel that analytical philosophy has done wonders for the current philosophical scene. I have used analytical techniques in many of my writings, and we're only dealing here with one particular unfortunate aspect of contemporary analytical philosophy. I think that Herbert Feigl was quite right when he said that analysis is the cure for which traditional philosophy is the disease. So this is not in any way hitting the analysts. But the analysts claim that the very uniqueness of the idea of God makes it nonsense. Because if you consider God unique as categorically different from everything else, as wholly other, as entirely other than what we experience, then quite obviously any statement made about him will be inaccurate. It'll be necessary to qualify any statement made about God. And the qualifications make it impossible to provide reliable assertions. Thus, in the words of R.M. Hare, God dies the death of 1,000 qualifications. He is qualified and qualified until finally he disappears. And it's interesting that in traditional philosophy and in traditional religion, God is generally defined by qualifications, and these are usually negative. He is immeasurable. He is incomprehensible. He is invisible, and so on. He is not this, and he's not that, and he's not the other thing. And under those circumstances, you never find out what he is. The great example of this criticism in contemporary philosophy is, of course, the famous parable of the gardener by John Wisdom and Anthony Flew, the so-called Flew Wisdom parable. And I find it basically comforting that a philosopher should be named Wisdom. I think that that's just wonderful. The Flew Wisdom parable goes like this. Once upon a time, two explorers came to a clearing in the jungle where there were growing many flowers and many weeds. Now, the two explorers here represent a believer in God and one who doesn't believe in God. And the clearing in the jungle represents the world, right? And the question is whether there is genuine order here and whether an orderer, a gardener, comes to tend this plot. The believer says there is, the unbeliever says there isn't. So they watch, they set a watch, and no gardener is ever seen. But then they remember H.G. Wells' Invisible Man. So they set up a barbed wire around the clearing, and they electrify it, and they patrol it with bloodhounds. But the bloodhounds never give a cry. There is no evidence of electric fence catching anyone. But in spite of all of this, the believer is not convinced. Says he, there is a gardener who comes secretly, who makes no sound, and he comes to take care of the garden which he loves. To which the unbeliever replies, but how does that kind of a gardener differ from an imaginary gardener or from no gardener at all? See? In other words, there is no evidence available for the existence of God, and the evidence by definition isn't going to be found because all that can be stated here are negativities. This is the death by 1,000 qualifications. In my book, Christianity for the Tough-Minded, I've described this in the popular terms of the big G problem. A question, how will you recognize God when you get to heaven? Answer, by the big G on his sweatshirt. The question is, how would you recognize God if you came across him, if he is unique, you see, and if no statements about him actually have meaning? All right. There are two answers to this, at least two answers to this, and one of them is a philosophical answer, the other is a theological answer, and I suggest that you use these as you feel they are particularly applicable. The most practical answer, the most helpful answer, is the theological answer, and I suggest that you definitely employ this. The philosophical answer to this is more difficult, and it'll depend entirely on the person that you're dealing with. Let's begin with the philosophical answer to this. The argument is, in essence, that uniqueness cannot be adequately described. In other words, if a thing is unique, then it is meaningless to talk about it, because anything you say about it will not be exactly accurate. But think about this for a moment. This is obviously a two-edged sword. Because God is not the only unique item around. There is a grammatical problem here, by the way, in that you are not supposed to qualify the word unique in English grammar. We're going to have to do this. It may well be that God is more unique than anything else, But there are other things that are unique as well. It's sort of like George Orwell's Animal Farm. All the animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. There are lots of uniquenesses, and God may be more unique than others, but the problem of talking about the unique is in no sense limited to God. Think about it for a moment. Remember when you were a little shaver and you heard the preacher from his pulpit say, "My dear friends, every little snowflake that falls is different from each other little snowflake." You well remember that. Now, the preacher didn't do a very adequate check on this. I've seen very few preachers out checking snowflakes to make sure that that assertion is correct, but I think we can say for all practical purposes that it probably is. Snowflakes differ from each other. If that uniqueness is genuinely there, how is it possible to say anything meaningful about any given unique snowflake? You say, why? Because it's similar in some respects to other things. Sure, exactly. And nobody is claiming that God has no similarities to anything or anyone else. So the parallel still rests. Let's get off the snowflakes and think of people. Each person, evidently, has a unique genetic pattern. The only exception to this is identical twins. But the minute that the two twins pop out into the world, they start having slightly different experiences. And thus, in no time at all, you have uniqueness operating there as well. How is it possible to talk meaningfully about people when each person is different from each other person? Yet we go ahead and do it. We are not stymied by this. We don't be quiet and say nothing about human beings simply because human beings are not identical to each other. Think of the events of history. It's a commonplace in history, in historical studies, to assert that each historical event is unique. You never get exactly the same event again. History doesn't repeat itself in that sense. There are similarities, to be sure, but the events are absolutely not identical to any other events, and yet we don't seem to have a great deal of difficulty in discussing them. If you think about historical events and you think about human beings, you notice that any time personality is introduced, there is an element of genuine uniqueness introduced. Indeed, it can be argued and has been argued that you've got to assume the uniqueness and the priority of human subjectivity in order to carry out any investigation at all. That is to say, you can't regard people as explainable by other factors in order, if you intend to carry out an investigation. You've got to assume that there is something that stands above the investigation, that is distinguished from it, and that isn't itself caused in order to be able to carry out an investigation. You've got to assume, in other words, a semi-transcendent state for the investigator. He has got to transcend the stuff that he's looking at. Otherwise, he simply blends with what he's investigating, and you don't end up with any results at all. Let me give you an example. Robert Benchley described his biology course in college in the following terms. He said, "I spent the entire term drawing the reflection of my own eyelash as it was projected by the microscope onto the slide." A total catastrophe. What happened here? What happened was that Benchley lost the distinction between himself as the observer and what was being observed. Another example of the same kind of thing. It has been suggested that Schiaparelli, who first pointed out the canali on Mars, the Italian canali meant simply gullies, but it's also similar to the word canals, so that, of course, people were thinking of man-made canals and so on. It's been suggested that Schiaparelli perhaps had incipient cataract and was drawing the vein structure of his own eye. Why? Because other people couldn't see the same canali that he was able to see. Now, anytime this happens, it becomes impossible to investigate anything. You've got to assume or presuppose a distinction between the subject who is engaged in investigation and the thing being observed. Another way of putting this is that you can't hyper-objectify. You can't hyper-objectify. Suppose a person says, Skinner, that there is an absolute determinism such that every act of will is nothing but the product of other factors. That would mean, of course, that the conclusions of Skinner don't have any necessary validity because they then turn out to be the necessary product of the influences that have come to bear on him. And by the same token, any investigation going on would have no necessary validity because it would simply be caused by the other factors. The upshot of this is that the priority and uniqueness of the human subject, the priority and uniqueness of the human subject have to be assumed in any investigation. All right, but that means that whenever we're dealing with human beings, we're dealing with priority and uniqueness. You can't say that a human being is simply the product of something else. He stands above that in a semi-transcendent fashion. His feet are on the ground, but as a matter of fact, he is above what he's investigating. That is no different from talking about God as unique. All we're saying is that when you begin treating human beings or the events in which they find themselves, historical events or laboratory events or whatever, you've got to assume uniqueness. If you don't assume it, you get nowhere. You can't even engage in an investigation. But clearly, we don't stop talking about ourselves as a result of this. We simply go ahead. Thus, we have a two-edged sword. And what this boils down to is that if you don't want to talk about God because of his uniqueness, shut up with reference to other people and with reference to yourself, because the same club that comes down on God comes down on the human beings who must have this uniqueness presupposed of them in order to make any meaningful statements. As Ian Ramsey, who has developed this very extensively, as Ian Ramsey, the late philosophical theologian in England, pointed out, we might perhaps say that we are as certain of God as we are of ourselves. Unquote. Very nice statement. We might perhaps say that we are as certain of God as we are of ourselves. In other words, if you want to say that we can't say anything meaningful about God, this also will apply to other human beings. And that's another illustration of our fundamental technique, right? The necessity of describing ourselves, though we are unique, if taken over and applied to the God question, makes it perfectly sensible to talk about God. Let's approach this, though, theologically as well. And I think this is most helpful in talking with a non-Christian. The analytical philosophers have come down good and hard on the non-Christian religions and on a great deal of contemporary theology through their flu wisdom parable. Because in all religions other than Christianity, God doesn't appear here on earth. You have to define him descriptively. You cannot define him denotatively. You cannot point to him. So when the philosophers look at the non-Christian religions, they see people defining God by negativities, by qualifications. And when they look at contemporary theology, they see liberals who are scared to death of the incarnation, who will not point to Christ and say, there, that's God. They see people like Karl Barth, who is basically, of course, a conservative theologian and has done great things for the Christian church, but they see a bard who makes a distinction between suprahistory and ordinary history, between Geschichte and Historie, and who says that the events of the incarnation are events that are not subject to ordinary history. They can't be checked out like ordinary events. You can't check out the virgin birth. You can't check out the resurrection of Christ. These are faith events. You've got to believe in them already in order to discover their facticity. And the philosopher looks at these and he says, well, isn't that interesting? What kind of a meaningful picture of God can you get there? Because every time it's a question of investigation, the theologian steps back and refuses to let you engage in it. When I had a debate with William Hordern, who wrote The Layman's Guide to Protestant Theology, he presented this sort of thing, and I said, you know, in my backyard, I have an elephant. It's, of course, my favorite elephant, the green one, I believe it was, eating the raspberry ice cream cone. And he's there in the backyard, and he's really there, but you can't investigate that he's there. And Hordern said, well, that's absurd. And I said, are you trying to make fun of my faith? You see, it's exactly that sort of thing. That's just the way the Bardian deals with the virgin birth and resurrection of Christ. He says they really happen, but you can't check them out. You can't check them in history. And then when someone says, well, that's absurd, he says, wait a minute, that's my faith. His voice deepens, and suddenly the thing is supposed to have greater significance to it. Sure, the contemporary theologian and the non-Christian religionist run into the death by a thousand qualifications. But that isn't true of historic Christianity. Historic Christianity says plainly and flatly that God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself. And therefore you can point to Jesus and you are pointing to God. You are pointing to God unqualifiedly. No qualification necessary. You remember when the women came to the tomb on Easter morning and they thought that they saw a gardener? That was the gardener that Flu and Wisdom were looking for. And it didn't require any barbed wire, required no bloodhounds, nothing special at all. The gardener that they were looking for, as a matter of fact, was Jesus. Now you say, but that's sermonic. You haven't proved that. Right! But that's what we get into tomorrow night, isn't it? Tomorrow night we're going to present the historical evidence that, as a matter of fact, this person was God Almighty. So, again, the best way to deal with the meaningfulness of the idea of God is by denotative definition. Point to Jesus Christ and say, that's what I mean by God. If the reply is, you mean that's all you mean by God? The answer to this is, no, it's not all that I mean by God, but it's no less than what I mean by God. In other words, if you come to meet Jesus Christ, if you come to understand what is meant by Christ, you will find that He will introduce you to dimensions of the idea of God that you didn't know before. But that's the place to start. And we'll see how, once you have been introduced to Jesus Christ on that level, that He in turn will show you the triune nature of God, that God is not only Son, but also Father and Holy Spirit.